Hey, welcome to the latest edition of No Filter Sports. It is January 20th, 2020. Martin Luther King Day. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Another day of the special day of the year that was last week. I want to bring up in relation. Danny McLean, Bob Page, and I am Eli Zarrett. And the Super Bowl is set. Let's start there. The Kansas City Chiefs is so interesting as the 49ers are in the midst of blowing out the Packers. Final 37-20, but it was 27-0 at the half. The Vegas already set the odds in the Super Bowl to make Kansas City slight favorites. Both agree, Kansas City over San Francisco? What do you like?
Well, you know I don't make picks on these things, and Denny does, and he's usually wrong.
Oh, really? Really? The last 2 weeks, I'm 100%.
Didn't you have Tennessee going to the Super Bowl, winning on the road?
No, he had Baltimore.
No, I know he had that initially. Then he had to redo his picks, and he still messed them up.
I would never pick Tennessee.
To answer your question, Eli, you know, never having been a sports gambler, I believe it or not, had a gambling system. And what I would have done had I gambled is the full weeks in NFL. Don't give me that look there, damn it. I'm trying to tell you something you might find interesting.
Okay,
and if you don't, I don't care because our listeners will. And
that's what
counts.
All right.
So what I would do is every NFL week of the season, I would look at all the games without the point spreads. I would make my own point spreads after seeing all the games from the previous day on Sunday, knowing what happened, knowing what's going on, make my own point spreads. Then I compare them to the bookies' official spreads out of Vegas, and they're pretty much, you know, within a couple points. That's pretty good. So you don't bet the games. But if you think there's a flaw in the line, like if I make somebody a five-point favorite and the bookies have the other team a one-point favorite, I think to myself, I don't think that's right.
What do you think to yourself about the game then?
So the minute – and you guys did this too to yourselves. Don't tell me you didn't. The minute we knew who was going to play in the Super Bowl on Sunday, you made your line in your head, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Who's going to be favored? What was your line on the Super Bowl, Denny?
After the game yesterday, I said it was going to be a pick 'em, and it was going to be 52 to 54 points for the over. That's exactly what I said.
So you thought it was going to be a four point favorite then?
No.
Pick 'em means there's never been a team.
There's never been a pick 'em in the history of Super Bowl wagering. Never.
It's not what he meant. Oh, my God.
That's not what I meant, Bob. It's what I was trying to imply was I said pick 'em, and most of the lines are 1 to 2 points, 2.5 points. That's about it. That's about the max.
Eli, what did you say?
Well, I didn't think of it because I hadn't seen the second game, and I didn't see this final score of the second game till very late at night. But I don't know. I say pick 'em too. I had no idea. Yeah. I didn't think anybody should be seriously favored at all.
So,
because they're both clearly the best two teams.
I'm looking at San Francisco's great defense, and of course they're both great offenses. And I thought because of the 49ers' defense, I'm going to make them a 1.5 point favorite over Kansas City. The line comes out, and Kansas City's a 1 point favorite.
Yes.
It's not a game I would have bet, but you know, it's just about, as you said, a pick 'em right here. It really is.
And why do you think KC is the favorite?
Why did I pick San Francisco? I just said because of their defense.
No, but why do you everybody else pick Kansas City to be the favorite. Why do you think everybody picked Kansas City to be the favorite? It's my opinion
versus theirs.
It's the quarterback. Quarterback.
There was a headline on ESPN this morning, is Mahomes the greatest quarterback in history? Which is a little bit of an exaggeration, I would think, a little early. But you know what? Remember 3 years ago, we were stunned when Matthew Stafford signed for $27.5 million.
Yeah.
It's going to be 40 next year with this kid.
A ton.
And by the way, when they were down 17-14, Kansas City, in the first half, this play by Mahomes was absolutely a jaw-dropper.
Incredible.
The blue lady, who's hot?
Second and 10 as that Tennessee defense drops back. As Long, who tried to make a diving, and tipped it. Mahomes, who tiptoes inside the 10. Still not down. Oh, what a run! Out of this world! Touchdown, Kansas City!
So the kid is rolling to his left, trying to find a receiver, can't find one, thinks I'll run, maybe I won't run, I'll look again, then I have to run. He runs around two guys and tiptoes down the sidelines, nestles the ball in his arms as he gets hit, and falls into the end zone for a touchdown.
Let me tell you one thing about him that's so impressive. Yes, he can run. Yes, he can throw, and he can throw the ball as far as anybody. He threw one pass yesterday, 75 yards, in the air, on the run. Now, but the best thing about him that I like him, he's number one, he's a tough kid. And you can see how tough he is because when he tries to run the last 30 yards in that one play, he was looking for somebody to hit. and he hit two guys just short of the goal line. I mean, the kid is tough. He likes the, he loves the game, obviously. I still think he'd be a hell of a pitcher.
If you watched, you saw Travis Kelce photobomb the post-game interview with Mahomes. He just jumped into the shot and started screaming, "This guy is the best quarterback in the NFL." But wait a minute. Everybody, including the noted football sage Dennis Dale McClain, was saying all season that Lamar Jackson of Baltimore was the best quarterback in the NFL until he laid that big egg in the playoffs against Tennessee. And I said, take a deep breath. Don't anoint him yet. So the deal is, what is this rush, as Eli said, even at the start of the San Francisco game? Buck and Aikman said, well, you got George Kittle. I mean, he's the greatest tight end in football. Yeah. Is he better than Kelce? Is he better than Zach Ertz or a handful of other players? So I'm not saying Mahomes is the best quarterback in the NFL, but he's up there. And they don't have to rush to judgment on this stuff.
Totally
he's just
agree.
A kid himself.
He is the best quarterback in the Super Bowl.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. He's best.
This guy Garoppolo had a fantastic year.
Oh, for
There's
God's
a reason
sakes,
the
only,
Niners' record is what it is.
Bob, the guy only threw 8 or 9 passes. Just stop it now, okay?
This time he didn't do that all year.
Bob, yes, he did. He threw very few passes all year. They have a great running offense. They will run the ball down somebody's throat. And Kansas City's got to figure out a way to stop that big guy coming out of that
backfield. They got two running backs, Denny. They're kind of interchangeable. This kid had the big game Sunday. The other kid out of Indiana, Tevin Coleman, had the big game before that.
Bob,
and they throw a lot of passes in San Francisco.
Bob, you got one guy that gets 180 yards 1 week. The next week he gets 175. The next week he gets 218. We're talking about one giant running back.
Now, excuse me. He's a great quarterback. Garoppolo's a great quarterback. I don't put him in Mahomes' class. And San Francisco has so much more, it doesn't really matter. You know, the front five of the Green Bay Packers couldn't protect Rodgers from the front four of Kansas City. An extra guy still couldn't block him. It's just they're an all-round amazing. What's up, Brandon? What?
I was going to let you finish your thought, but just for the record, San Fran does not have one guy at all. They had Coleman, Mostert, and Breida split. Three guys split all year long. One had 550 yards, one had 770 yards, one had 620 yards. You don't have the one big guy, but what you have is a three-headed monster.
They have several great running backs. Tevin was the week before that. Mostert, by the way, 220 yards on Sunday, 29 carries. This guy... By the way, and here are his three. He had four touchdowns. Here are his last three.
Mostert in the backfield. He gets it. Samuel out in front. Touchdown. And here he is again. Mostert touchdown, his third. Mostert left side. Another first down carry and more. How about a touchdown?
The guy is not so amazing that, by the way, he plays. He's amazing that he's still in the league. He was cut by seven teams. He was cut by four teams his first year as an undrafted free agent. Philadelphia, Miami, Baltimore, Cleveland. He's been on the practice squad. He was about to give up after 15. His wife said to stay in the game. He had made the 53-man roster at Cleveland. They cut him the next day. And so with San Francisco, he's really a great special teams player. Came from Purdue. He's just a great story of how hard it is to make it in the NFL, unless you're one of the rare, you know, first-round draft picks. And the persistence, the perseverance of a guy like Raheem Mostert, how can you not just have great respect for this guy? Terrific, terrific player. And an amazing team, and frankly, to try and pick in this game is just too hard.
And two other quick things. Number one, Kansas City has really come a long way the second half with their defense. They're really playing well defensively. But nobody's got an offensive line like San Francisco, and they've had it for a while. And now we're all getting to see how strong and how big that offensive line is. They push everybody off the line.
You see, by the way, that Richard Sherman, who's never exactly shy, makes a fool of himself almost every time he opens his mouth. Do you see who he's feuding with? He's still feuding with Jim Harbaugh. Oh, yes. Big articles over the weekend. This apparently stems from their time together at Stanford, where Sherman played for Harbaugh, the head coach. Jimmy accused him of quitting on the team after a season-ending injury in 2008. Asked him if he'd consider transferring, and eventually moved him to defensive back, which turned out to be a great thing for Sherman. The San Jose Mercury News wrote this, distributed nationally, said they had trouble, Jimmy and his staff had trouble dealing with Sherman's, quote, colorful persona. In 07, Harbaugh reportedly suspended Richard Sherman for yelling at teammates during a loss to Washington. And Ron Lynn, who was then Stanford's defensive coordinator, told the Mercury News that Sherman had been acting like a diva and a spoiled brat. Those are quotes. 1 year during spring practice, demanding quarterbacks throw him the ball as a wideout. Sherman then said he was given a contract that required him to take 20 credit hours in a quarter, which is a lot, pay back loans he received, and move back to campus.
Bob, how is this relevant?
Because we're doing a show, in case you guys haven't noticed.
We are, Bob.
It's a Detroit-based show. Did you know that? And the University of Michigan is down the road, and all of our listeners are very interested in Jim Harbaugh on Michigan. And you'll be hearing more about the story, because if you didn't know this, Eli, Richard Sherman is one of the most famous players in the Super Bowl.
I know.
Do you understand, Eli?
He's probably the best defensive back in the NFL, and he has been for a number of years.
Yes. Well, Eli doesn't want to talk about it. Doesn't think it's
relevant. We've been talking about it.
Listen, he had trouble in Seattle, too. He clashed with Russell Wilson. We know all about that stuff. It's not relevant, though, I don't think, to this game coming up. So be it.
I must humbly disagree with you. It's a good story, and we talk about personalities on this show, if you haven't noticed that.
Fine.
Now, did you get up on the wrong side of bed this morning,
No,
Eli?
No, I didn't.
You seem especially uptight, more so than usual.
I just think that you know, to talk about the personalities of these players and to go back 12 years.
That's what you're talking about for the next 2 weeks.
Okay,
because they got 2 weeks to fill.
Let's go back 50 years, okay? Because it was in 1969 for the 1970 Super Bowl that these Chiefs were last in it. And you will appreciate NFL film. By the way, Steve Sable, son of Ed Sable, is being put into the NFL Hall of Fame this year. And it's because of incredible voices, like the voice of John Facenda talking
about the voice
about
of God,
the great 50
voice.
Years ago Kansas City Chiefs.
In an age when most football coaches are still imitating Vince Lombardi's fundamental approach to the game, Hank Stram, the coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, stands apart as an original thinker. In 1969, his progressive theories made Kansas City the most entertaining team in all of football.
And of course, that team of Bobby Bell and Curly Culp and Buck Buchanan and Ed Podolak and Otis Taylor changed the way the game was played. The NFL was kind of more of a defensive struggle then, and the AFL really brought it to life. And that 23-7 victory 50 years ago, it's amazing it's been that long. Actually, we have another team we know that hasn't been in the Super Bowl in a long time, come to think of it. Actually, never in the Super Bowl.
Are you guys pissed off yet at the way Fox handles all of its games? All of a sudden, you're trying to watch the game, and there's a shot of what's quote-unquote celebrity now. So yesterday, they cut to a shot of Rob Lowe in the stands. I mean, I know who that is, obviously. I think most people do. He's wearing an NFL cap. And why are they showing Rob Lowe in the stands? He was
promo.
One of the few guys that did it. Guess what?
The promo.
Because a Rob Lowe special TV show on Fox was coming up right after the game.
Well, that's
fans. Look, you want to promo your show? Do it. You don't have to put the celebrities in prime seats. It just drives me crazy. Easy with these people.
But that's the reason why they have the celebrities come to the game, so they can promote their shows.
I agree. It's
so, Eli, did you notice there was another graphic on this game yesterday? And they talked about Aaron Rodgers being drafted in the 2005
selections by
the Packers with the 24th pick. And I'm like, 24 picks? And I asked, I wonder who the NFL's picked that year. I went back and said, they picked the immortal Mike Williams, wide receiver, when they could have taken Aaron Rodgers. And then there were some other great players, Sean Merriman and other guys, who came right after the NFL's pick that year. And hindsight's 20/20, but come on. You know what I'm saying?
That was Matt Millen. Of course, he had taken Charles Rodgers several years before that. How'd that turn out? So, by the way, the game will be on Fox. And the announcers 50 years ago when the Chiefs upset Joe Capp, By the way, Joe Capp didn't slide. Joe Capp came from the CFL. Joe Capp took tacklers on, lowered his head and shoulder, went right into him.
Absolutely.
But, Alan Page, Paul Krause, Carl Eller, the great Purple People Eaters were pretty much handled by Len Dawson. By the way, and Len Dawson wasn't very highly regarded because he was a backup in the NFL for years.
And Lamar Hunt, who was the biggest gambler in the NFL, took that quarterback and made him a degenerate gambler. So the two of them were exchanging tips and points and the team information. Well, and they say Lamar made tens of millions of dollars in the NFL.
Well, he was a billionaire. And, yeah. and the average salary, by the way, in the NFL in 1971
was nothing.
$23,000 a year. So I'm sure.
And by the way, fellas, there was another quarterback who played for the Kansas City Chiefs that the NFLs did manage to select. And when they did manage to take the legendary John Hadel, I remember because I had seen, you know, the Barker, Russ Thomas said, he's not going to sign with the AFL.
Oh, yeah.
That's a BS league. We're going to offer him $3 an hour plus tips. And if he doesn't like it, tough. Well, John Hadel didn't sign with the AFLs. He did sign with Kansas City. And the rest is football history.
By the way, the anthem, whose halftime is going to be J-Lo and Shakira. I don't know a lot about Shakira. But the national anthem, by the way, for the 1970 Super Bowl, the Chiefs Vikings, was Doc Severin.
Doc Severinsen.
And Pat O'Brien did the singing. But here's what's interesting, too. Jack Buck did the play-by-play, and his son Joe Buck will do the play-by-play for this one. Anyway, I'd like to see Andy Reid get his due. He's one of the greatest, most respected coaches. And the other, it's interesting because the 49ers coach, Kyle Shanahan, was the offensive coordinator, was it 4 years ago, 3 years ago, when Atlanta blew that 28-3 lead in the Super Bowl, and his play calling enraged his quarterback, Matt Ryan. And to this day, Shanahan rues the performance he had back then. So they both have they all have something to prove.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the 49ers.
I think it'd be nice to see Andy Reid win it for another reason. The 49ers have had their fill. They've won so many Super Bowls, five in their history. Tops in the NFL is, of course, six.
Yeah.
And you look at those great, and they are great fans in Kansas City. These Chiefs fans are amazingly loyal. I think it'd be really nice to see Kansas City win the game.
I do too.
Bob, you can bet on it.
Yep. Yeah, I would favor them also. I like to. I don't always root for somebody, but I would root for them in the game. By the way, Tom Brady, who is not in the news now because he's not playing, did make some news saying he's open-minded about the process on his weekly show that he would consider going for another team. Doesn't know what the future may hold. I want to get more into what he was doing when he made that quote, or where he was seen over the weekend talking to the Raiders owner Mark Davis. At first, I want to tell you that. If you want to see 2020 you know where to go. You go to the Yaldo Eye Center and get rid of those glasses, those contacts, and those incredibly bothersome reading glasses that I finally got rid of by getting multifocal lenses from Dr. Yaldo. Of course, I had cataracts. A lot of people 45-plus are going for this amazing technology where you'll never need reading glasses again. You'll never get cataracts. You'll see far, perfectly, and up close, too. Same with LASIK. He's done over 30,000 LASIK procedures, the most in the state. He's the most respected and the most experienced. 99% of people are good LASIK candidates, and 99% I'll go to Dr. Yaddle, and we'll see better than 2020. So do what a lot of our listeners have done. Those are the Drew and Mike Show also. Make the call, 1-800-398-EYES. That's 800-398-EYES. Or go to YaldoEyeCenter.com and get rid of those glasses, contacts, and reading glasses.
And do you need some money? Hall Financial is there with lots of money, and we've got a couple of questions for you. Are you paying more than 4% on your mortgage? Do you have lingering high-interest rate credit card debts? Fact is that rates remain within fractions of a percentage point of their lows for the past 10 years. Recently, Hall Financial has been averaging 10 days from start to finish for our listeners who have applied for a refi on their mortgage. It's a simple process. Get started by calling 248-308-5000 or going to DavidHallMortgage.com. A lot of homeowners need to reduce their rate, shorten their term, or take cash out. Hall Financial gets testimonials every week and thanks you every week from listeners who have sent to Hall Financial all of those check-ins. And you can check out our reviews, folks. Hall Financial has nearly 1,000 five-star reviews from
their clients.
Will you
get through this damn thing?
Will you zip it, you little weasel?
Go ahead.
Go to DavidHallMortgage.com to get started or call 248-308-5000 and make sure to tell them No Filter Sports has sent you. That's Eli and Denny, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 1467435, Eli and Denny.
You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. How can you make a one-minute ad seem like it lasts 5 minutes? You have an incredible knack.
Eli, that's a great question, but I got a better question. How could you have a guy here on this program, and this is just a fact, who made a lot of money in New York City doing professional voiceover work, and you do a commercial on this show, and I don't?
You're more than welcome to do some. In fact, I'll
send me all Denny's copy in the future. I'll do them all.
No, I'll let you do the other two, and I'll do.
Yeah, let's see him do a gambling one. Let's give him a gambling one. Let's see if he knows what.
Hey, so Eli, I got another question for you. You told me on the phone before we started a really interesting story about Aaron Hernandez. You want to do that now, or you want to do it later in the program?
We could talk about it now. I'd heard that Drew and Mike is going to have Dan Wetzel on. Dan Wetzel is from Detroit, and he writes for Yahoo Sports. He has for many, many years, a great sports writer, and he one of the executive producers on the Aaron Hernandez. What's the name of the mind of Aaron Hernandez? I think it was called fascinating, a 3-hour documentary on Netflix. And I was kind of blown away by it. And it was called Killer Inside, the Mind of Aaron Hernandez. Aaron Hernandez, it reveals on this, had a homosexual relationship with a high school football player when he grew up in Bristol, Connecticut. You know, you look at him as a teenager, the nicest kid, respectful, came from a good family. He was just the perfect kid. And something happened, something went wrong, but a lot of it could be his hidden sexuality, because his father, Dennis Hernandez, who was the big man in town, led all the youth, it was loved in town. They called him the king. He was in charge of all the youth football and everything, but he was blatantly and very much homophobic. So Aaron had this incredible, crushing doubt, this crushing vulnerability that he could be discovered while he was fulfilling whatever his inner, you know, self told him that he was.
Well, let me ask you a question about his gayness. What did he consistently say he was gay? Did he?
Oh no, he denied it his entire life. No. In fact,
never heard it.
When he had a second trial, because it was revealed because he murdered Odin Lloyd, who was a friend of his,
right,
in a rage, and it was revealed that he had when they went to check on something for that, they saw the vehicle that the police been looking for 2 years from a drive-by shooting in Boston, where he murdered two guys who he had thought had come after him in a bar. Not come after him. He was thought he was being tried. The guys would try him. So just a very troubled sort.
But Eli, you told me they outed him. Now, why would you out somebody for their sexuality? Who did that and why?
It was on a talk show in Boston, right?
Michelle McPhee on WEEI.
Yeah, she outed him, and it was true. He committed suicide 2 days later. But, you know,
The traditional machismo culture.
Yeah.
The Spanish word for homosexual is a derogatory term, maricón.
Yep.
And this is what uneducated people sometimes use. So among these kind of people, you just can't be gay, which is why he hid it for so long. You even mentioned his father's attitude towards gay people. And this whole thing, as you said, he must have been a great kid. What a human tragedy. Well, and in so many respects, the people he killed, what happened to him, being outed. You know, it's what an awful story.
Well, wait a minute. Let's not make him a victim. He's certainly not a victim. He's a murderer. He's a killer. He's a degenerate.
Yeah, well, I think you have to look at both sides of it. Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
I mean, how do you take three or four lives and nobody's defending this? Are they here?
No, nobody's defending him. But, you know, just to show some of the pressure he was under. Now, former Patriots player Ryan O'Callaghan is in this. He came out gay in 2017 after his career was over. He played with Aaron, and he says football is an almost perfect hiding place for gay men. He says, my beard was football. I relied on all the stereotypes of a football player, a lot of testosterone and aggressiveness, hitting each other, things you assume middle America wouldn't think of as gay men. But he never acted on it because he said to suppress it and fear of it coming out would have been more than he could take. So Aaron was dealing with all that. But here's the last thing. They donated his brain, his family did, to science, and the greatest CTE research has been done in Boston. I forget the name of the hospital, a woman named McKee and a few others, and looking at his brain at 27, severe CTE, which causes rage, anger, confusion, paranoia. He was very, very paranoid. He killed the two guys because they spilled a drink on him on a bar. These are the most innocent guys, totally inoffensive, recent immigrants, no agenda, and he just murdered them. So, yes, he was a very, 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 very troubled man, but it was a fascinating feature.
You want to go to baseball now? We'll talk about the brouhaha that continues to rage unabated. ESPN, I'm sure you guys saw this, was out with the results of a survey it did over the weekend, in which it said more than half of all Major League Baseball fans believe Houston Astros players should be penalized along with the team management guys in the aftermath of the sign-stealing scandal. In addition, the vast majority across America, 72% of adults and 76% of those people who call themselves MLB fans, said they would support MLB taking additional steps to punish players who were involved in sign stealing. And a plurality, 50-some percent to 40-some percent, support the action that MLB took,
you know,
doing
Bob,
what they did, and the owners took in firing managers.
Listen, I'm going to say it again what I said the other day. I feel so unqualified to talk about this subject because I never played Major League Baseball. I didn't steal signs. And we've got such a spectrum here of people saying it's overreaction, it doesn't matter, some players don't want signs, to people saying now they should strip the Astros of their title.
Yeah, I heard
so there's
that
this incredible
too.
Spectrum of response. And I was surprised because a lot of players came out this week and said it. Now, the other thing that I think is nonsense is Trevor Bauer tweeted Thursday that he's heard from multiple parties that the system also involved players, meaning Altuve and Bregman, wore buzzers inside their uniforms.
But they have discounted that now. They have cleared that.
Okay, because Scott Boras came out and said that they didn't.
Right, it's absolutely wrong.
Now, Danny Valencia, 9-year Major League Baseball player, third baseman with 8 teams, still plays, says that the reports of cheating from the Astros are next level. If it's 100% true, then the World Series in 17 should be stripped, as well as the individual awards, including Altuve MVP. This is a very extreme. Now, I thought when Rick Pitino in Louisville went through all their NCAA violations in 13, they took the title away from them. Didn't they take the title away? But they didn't give it to Michigan. They stripped them of their title, but they didn't give it
to
Michigan.
They didn't give it to anybody.
So what's the point of taking it away unless you're going to give it? They'd have to give it to the Dodgers then. And speaking of the Dodgers, one of their pitchers, Alex Wood, who the Astros defeated in 2017, tweeted, "I would rather face a player that was taking steroids than face a player that knew every pitch was coming." Now, I don't think you agree with that.
No. Number one, you do not want to know. Believe me, the majority of people that I played with do not want to know what's coming. For the obvious reason, Tony Conigliaro, I bring that up because Tony, they say, was leaning over home plate looking for a curveball when Jack Hamilton threw the fastball inside and destroyed his whole life. But here's a statistic that really got my attention. They did a poll in Major League Baseball, sophisticated. They paid for it, as a matter of fact. 86% of the people they talked to said they wanted some form of punishment for the Astros.
For the players.
For the players. They want the players to be punished.
Not just management.
Yeah, and see, that was the first question I asked the other day. Why are the players getting away with this?
Well, I think you go to the – well, that's a good question, but you've already – 3 managers – great manager. Well, of course, Carlos Beltran never had a chance to manage, right, but he was one of the masterminds behind this with the Astros. Alex Cora and A.J. Hinch lost their jobs also, which must be a terrible overreaction for those that look at it from that side. Mike Clevenger of the Indians, great right-handed pitcher. Now you're telling me that could have potentially shortened my career or sent me back down to the minors because they knew what I was throwing when I was in their park. And here's an overreaction. Congressman Bobby Rush, Democrat, Illinois.
Yeah.
Shut up, Bobby, calling for a congressional hearing related to the baseball's sign-stealing scandal. That is a huge overreaction.
I don't care what the controversy is. The politicians trying to get a name for themselves always step in, I'm going to solve this. And that's their 15 minutes of fame. And fortunately, that's a name we'll never again mention on this show.
Go ahead, Bob. Go ahead.
I was going to say the most idiotic reaction on this, they actually went to Bregman and they said, "So what do you think about this? What are your thoughts?" Bregman said, and I quote, "I have no thoughts on it."
End quote.
So Alex, in other words, you have sawdust in your head instead of brains. Now, if you don't want to talk about it, you say, "I'm not going to comment on that."
Yeah.
But you don't say, "I have no thoughts on it." Oh, really? They fired your manager?
Yeah.
Really? And everybody's
now
talking about taking your title away. You have no thoughts?
Now, to go on top of what Mike Clevenger just said about how it could cost him, you know, his career because guys knew it were coming. Yu Darvish pitched very, very well for the Dodgers in the playoffs. But then he got it against Houston in the World Series, gave up 4 runs in 1.2 innings, or an inning and 2 outs in the game 3, and then again hit hard in game 7. It may have cost him tens of millions of dollars on his free agent contract if they're found guilty of using electronic. Well, that's the other thing. And then here's this. Jack McDowell, been out of baseball.
Yes, that's what I've been trying to get to here.
He said Gatorade had a sign out in right center field in Chicago. There was a toggle switch in the manager's office. That manager, by the way, is Tony La Russa.
Tony La Russa.
Zoomed in on the catcher, and he said, I'm going to whistleblow this now because I'm getting tired of this crap. He said La Russa had the system installed. He was also the manager when the Oakland A's had all the performance-enhancing drug users in the 80s, and Tony La Russa is a Hall of Famer.
And what he also said was, and this guy's making $500,000 a year being a consultant advisor for the California Angels, and I'm sick and tired of it. I'm tired of people getting away with all this stuff. Listen, most guys, again, I'll repeat myself, they don't want the signs. They don't want to know. They want to just go up and play the game.
So what do you think should happen? Why don't you give me your is the commissioner right to make it a huge investigation and change rules and deal with the technology and maybe not allow players to look at their video?
I think it's quick and I think it's easy. I think what you do is you find out every player that participated and you fine them $50,000, $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, whatever they
but
can.
But leave them alone. Right.
And leave them alone. Let the game be the game. Play the game, for God's sake. Here's what gets me to Darvish. Darvish and a number of other guys. Who's the lefty for the Yankees? Sabathia, right? All of a sudden, they're blaming somebody grabbing the signs on their failure last year pitching that they lost this game or lost that game. Get over it, for God's sakes. I mean, listen, you weren't winning 25 ball games ever before anyway. So what it may have cost you a game? Because I just don't believe that. That's the problem.
Probably an overreaction.
What I was going to say is this. You can tell most guys what's coming. Most guys what's coming, and they would still hit what they hit, 250, 220, 310.
I'm not going to argue. Now, Jerry Longman, who writes for the New York Times, he quoted an ethics professor at Arizona State University, not a baseball guy, an ethics professor.
Yeah.
He says, quote, rules against electronic sign stealing seem pretty stupid. The supposition that a video monitor provides a dramatically significant advantage over a human camera, which is the eye, to steal signs, strike me as a little bit far-fetched. Can't everybody look at what's on TV and see what it is? There's a camera in center field. We see what the catcher is throwing. It's right there in front of everybody. So, yeah. But
here's the thing about that.
Yeah.
When there's a guy on second base, obviously they change the signals. Now you'll see a catcher flash four or five
signs. It's legal to steal signs when you're on second base. It is legal.
Yes. Right. But the deal is, what they're going to do is they're going to look at videotapes of a lot of different games. They're going to look at all five or six signs the catcher flashes. Then they're going to see what kind of pitch is coming up. So after that, they probably can figure out, even looking at five signs, what order they're going to go in. Is it the third sign is the real pitch that's going to be thrown, and figure it out that way. I would guess. I don't know.
There
is a system by which we use as pitchers with the glove once in a while, with our hands once in a while. And if we touch ourselves once or twice, it went from a fastball to a changeup, went from a fastball to a slider, that type of stuff. So it isn't anything that's automatic, and that's the reason why you do a lot of things with a guy on second base. You just make sure.
But the deal is, what percentage of time in a baseball game is somebody on second base? Probably about 10 or 15% of the time.
Right.
So what's interesting, I think, here is that the line is blurred here between part of baseball's charm is gamesmanship, trickery. It makes the game endearing, shrewdness, the cunning larceny, the wily deceit, rules like the spitball, the greaseball. Gaylord Perry admitted in an autobiography in 1974, throwing the spitball, and he still was the lovable Gaylord that was elected to the Hall of Fame.
And a Hall of Famer, right.
Yep. Anyway, right. Rob Manfred says, that's the baseball commissioner, new protocols will absolutely be in place by opening day to curb the misuse of technology around baseball.
The one good thing they're going to do is they're going to isolate that room where the television is and where they're talking to each other in New York, so the players will not have access to that room anymore like they do now. You know, they were hitting and going back and looking what they just made an out with in the room with the people.
The last thing to be discussed with this is what happens to Mike Fiers, who fired everybody up by doing this. So he's a whistleblower, and this could have, and he also benefited from it in 17.
Big time.
And so
got a check for $400,000, by the way.
What's going to happen for the rest of his life, having come forward and
Well, that's a pretty easy question to answer. He comes back to the Detroit Tigers, for whom he briefly played, and immediately at age 48, which I think Fiers is now, becomes the Tigers' second best starter, right? Is that right?
Maybe the ace.
All right, boys, so I was trying to say, on Thursday morning, last, as I always do, I was minding my own business, reading the internet, trying to prepare for our show.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as always, about 9:30 or so, Eli calls me, when he's driving to the studio. We just BS and we're planning the show, what we're going to talk about. So we were talking about our guest that day, Milt Wilcox. And Eli said to me, you know, Milt was the only guy to play for Sparky in both seasons, George Kell would say.
I remember
the
billing
Cincinnati
him.
Ball Club.
I remember
and
billing
the
him.
Tigers.
As you were saying it, I remember Jack Billingham, and then you said it, and I said, boy, I threw
may
Bob
I,
under the
may
bus.
May I continue my story?
Go ahead.
May
go
I continue
ahead.
This story? So, boy, Denny Eli's really on edge this morning.
Well, I
so
think
I told
he's
Eli,
close.
I said, yeah, that's a really interesting angle. So I went ahead and asked Wilcox that during our interview, and both Milt and Eli, who hadn't bothered to research Eli's original statement, and I didn't either, jumped on me and both said, no, Jack Billingham was the other. There were two guys who played for Sparky in both places. Silly, silly me. I took that to Twitter. And I tweeted that day to announce that Milt was on the show. Hey, only two guys ever, or one guy ever played. So anyway, I got these hits back from a whole bunch of guys on Twitter over the next 3 hours. You ready for these names?
Yes, sir.
Champ Summers.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Collins. Ray Knight. Doug Flynn.
No kidding.
Doug Bear. And who among us could ever forget? Eli and I covered, of course, those Tiger teams. The great Harry Spillman. They played for Sparky in Cincinnati and in Detroit. And we owe all this abject humiliation and, of course, the debt of gratitude to these guys who kept correcting this on the Twitter feed in rapid-fire succession. Tiger Mike, 1975. Terry Paxis.
Okay, enough.
A guy whose Twitter handle is only – Denny, get this. His Twitter handle is triple short of a cycle. Gary Moore. Perry and our loyal listener, C. Michael Raymond, and God, I hope I'm not forgetting anybody who helped make a fool out of all of us.
Yeah, I was wrong. I take that one back.
By the way, Bob, I'm going to tell you why Eli's been so uptight today. It's a very serious reason. It's because he's sitting too close to my Red Bull.
Now, here's what I'm a little confused about. Last week, Wednesday, was National Bagel Day. I know this isn't a sports story, but I'm thinking
it was a great day.
National Bagel Day. You know, when I was a kid, and I hate to go back, but I like to go back like I just did by playing Hank's the John Facenda, the NFL films from 1970. A bagel was Jew food. You didn't find a bagel except in a Jewish deli, and it usually came with cream cheese and lox. Then something happened in the 70s where a company named Lenders made frozen bagels.
Yeah.
Because that's what a bad look. What a bad bagel that was. And then something happened that turned bagels into a $90 multi-billion industry. It used to mark you as a Jew when you ate a bagel. Now you go down to Comerica Park and Tim Hortons has got the bagel race. Is the bagel? You're going to work for the bagel, the coffee, or the donut? Going around.
So Eli is a native New Yorker, and I am a New Yorker, too, after living there over 30 years. Big headlines the other day, because Mayor Bill de Blasio went into a bagel place in New York and committed one of the worst sins ever, something neither Eli nor I would ever do. He orders a bagel in Manhattan and says, I want it toasted, please. Toasting a bagel?
That's okay.
You don't toast a bagel? I mean, they're fresh. That's what they're there for.
You can toast it. But on National Bagel Day, they revealed that the second most popular topping to a bagel is bacon. Now, imagine being a Jew in the 60s, and they say it's going to be putting bacon on a bagel.
I'm going to try that today.
Oh, God.
By the way, there's a big event coming up the next day or so. It's called the Hall of Fame.
Can we get to that as well as Martin Luther King Day and the Pistons?
I'd love to do that.
Let me first talk to you, though, about – you know what I'm going to talk about.
Oh, I want to hear about this.
My navigator.
That navigator. What a dynamite car. You drove up this morning, you know, we all stopped.
That's right.
Because we didn't want you to run over us.
Well, you're probably wondering, is that the Navigator, is that the Aviator, or is that the Corsair? They kind of look the same from the front, but these are Starlinkin's three remarkable SUVs that led to a stunning 20% sales increase for Lincoln back in 2019. That fourth one, of course, is that Navigator. That's the big one, the 2018 North American Truck of the Year. These are great cars, and Hoop McInerney's Star Lincoln is the best dealership in town. It's the only one that I've been going to for the last 10 years, long before they became a sponsor for my show. I love the Nautilus, and I agree with what one reviewer describes. It has a distinctly plush ride, relaxed driving dynamics, very easy to drive, especially for a car that big. I find it extremely comfortable. Here's what it really comes down to. Which one of Star Lincoln's Fab Four SUVs best fits your taste and lifestyle? easy to figure out. Just visit Detroit's premier Lincoln dealership, Hoop McInerney Star Lincoln, where everyone gets the renowned treatment at 12 and Telegraph in Southfield. You're going to get great treatment when you call Luke Nowacki. Luke's our Pinnacle Wealth Strategies, our wealth manager that sponsors our show and the others in the Red Shovel Network, 248-663-4748. Luke will create a plan to help you reach your financial goals, whether you're retirement and you're fast approaching, whether you're young and got to think about family obligations all through the following decades. Check out Luke. He deals with people in all age brackets and will give you a plan to reach your financial goals, and the consultation is complimentary. It'll answer all your questions for as long as you need. Again, call 248-663-4748. Luke Nowacki, Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. Advisory services offered through Royal Alliance Associates, Inc. Other marketing names, products, services, references here are independent of Royal Alliance Associates. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Okay.
Hall of Fame.
Oh, you want to talk about the Hall of Fame? Yeah. I don't have anything on that. Go ahead. What do you got?
A couple things. Number one, the guys that are on the list that apparently have a chance. Well, Derek Jeter, it's a slam dunk.
We all
know that. The only thing is, he going to get 100% of the vote? I just don't think so, but he'll be pretty close. They're talking about Bobby Abreu, and they're talking
Bobby Abreu won't make it. Come on, Bobby Abreu. Bobby, seriously?
Well, I'm just listing the ones that they've got listed on their sheets. Jason Giambi.
No.
Larry Walker.
Wait a minute.
There's a name.
Time out. Jason Giambi admitted to taking steroids.
Yes.
So you can't put him in and not put in Clemens and Bonds and McGuire and all the others. Giambi admitted it.
Absolutely. And you got Curt Schilling is on the list, and he's in the fame class for 2020.
He deserves it for his baseball performance, but he's being blackballed because of his radical
attitude. Views. And forget his political.
He hates everybody.
He hates everybody. And by the way, he did take down the state of Massachusetts for about $85 million.
Yeah, that's right. With his, he had some
software.
Some software plan that didn't work.
That's the big list at this point in time.
Yeah.
And you know, when you start talking about these guys and measure them up to some of the guys already in there, you got the Greg Maddux, Pedro Martinez, Randy Johnson, Ken Griffey, Chipper Jones. I mean, who I thought should have been in a long time ago.
Well, they're all in. So
yeah.
None of the names.
My point is, there's only one guy, as far as I'm concerned, with all these names that measures up to any of the guys I just mentioned.
Jeter.
And it's Jeter.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Eventually, going to run short.
All right. Well, we want to wish everybody today, as we record this on Monday morning, a special happy Martin Luther King Day. That holiday, being made a federal holiday, was just so long in coming. It was embarrassing. So finally we have had it. Full slate of NBA games. The Pistons actually, of course, you know what happened in the game by the time you hear this. Pistons actually are playing at Washington, 2:00 on Monday afternoon on local TV, I guess, in Detroit. So the other thing I think is interesting about that is that we've been talking for a while. What are they going to do with Drummond? He's going to be a free agent. They got to try to trade him and not get much of a return. They're going to re-sign him. So now, on the last show, we talked about this French kid, the Pistons rookie, 19 years old, who, except for the last game, played real well and looks like he's going to be maybe a star. In the Detroit News on Monday, here comes writer Matt Schock, and he's talking about Svi Mykhailiuk of the Ukraine with the Pistons and how good he looks. So you're looking at these two kids in particular, and Eli, you watch the Pistons a lot more than I do. It is time to think this way. Get off your butts in the front office, Tom Gorris, and sign Drummond to an extension, whatever he wants.
No.
Derrick Rose still has plenty left in the tank. We've been seeing that. And maybe, Blake Griffin's going to be okay physically next year. Now you got a basketball team, don't you?
I think they're going to go the opposite direction.
And Blake is never going to be 100% again. I'm sorry.
They are finally going to do what the Philadelphia 76ers did and tank, because they've already tanked. Nobody's watching. There's as much interest in this team now as there was when they were drawing 3,000 at Cobo Arena back in the mid-70s when they were awful. As many as they drew at the Silver Dome, they're getting 2,000 people huddled in their winter coats in an 80,000 seat arena as they struggle to be 16-66 in 1979. They need to do what Philadelphia did, and I think they're going to do it finally, because Joe Dumars, and this is the mistake, and I don't want to just rip on Joe Dumars, but he thought he could rebuild on the fly. In 2008, they made the Eastern Conference Finals for the sixth straight year. And what Joe tried to do was instead of letting Chauncey and Rip and these guys play it out, get later in their careers, they were making the Eastern Conference Finals, he decided to trade their most popular player. Chauncey Billups was the orchestrator. He was beloved in this town, beloved in that team, and he brought in that little cancerous Allen Iverson, and it destroyed everything, and they still haven't recovered. They've tried to be mediocre. As I said, they haven't had a draft pick higher than seventh. Need to do it Philadelphia. They got Embiid. They got Simmons. They had some years that were terribly 10-72. Nobody cares right now about the Pistons. So take your lumps. Take this young guy, the rookie. Take whoever else you have that you mentioned, the Slovakian player, whoever he is, and build from there. So yeah, that's what it's going to take.
That's what I'm saying. And here's the thing about the Pistons also, Eli. Their draft number this year, their specific pick in the draft, is likely going to change. Now, the Wizards are utterly woeful. And again, you all know what happened in the game by now. So they should beat Washington. Then they come home for four straight games at home against some of the NBA's lesser lights. You could be looking here at Washington and five straight wins, and now they're moving up.
Bob,
now they're moving up down in the draft.
Down, right. So the worst thing they could do is finish 42-42 or 41-41. And
could make the playoffs, yeah.
So they can lose, this thing gets swept by Milwaukee again.
Yep.
The biggest, they should have rebuilt years ago, and instead, and so Dumars trades Chauncey for Allen Iverson. Rip Hamilton goes into the tank, and they wind up with $21 million in cap space and buy two players who were either done or were never any good. And that's Ben Gordon, had a great playoff the year before with the Bulls against the Celtics. He was an undersized shooting guard that angered Hamilton even further. First they anger him with bringing Iverson and put him in the bench. Then they bring in Ben Gordon, put him in the bench. It was just a disaster. And if they had just kept the team, let it get old, rebuilt, we wouldn't have had 12 years without a single playoff victory. And, you know, right now they're ranked 22 out of the 30 teams in the power ranking. What good is that to be 16-27? If you were 6-35.
Tell them not to win, Eli. It just is what it is. They're going to try to play hard, and they're going to try to win.
They need They need Zion Williamson, a player like that, in the draft with a number one or two picks. Anyway, it was just awful. I was there when they were good, and I was there when they were bad. And trust me, it's no fun. It's no fun being on a team as bad as they were.
And on the surface, it appears that nobody's really trying to improve the ball club. It's just like, we want to get through this season, and then let's see what we do, because we got to see if the big guy's going to play next year.
Yeah,
you know, he ever be good again?
The trade. Why Stan Van Gundy? That's on that blood on Gore's hand. Yeah. Why he made that? They should trade. And by the way, if they don't trade Drummond, they'll get nothing.
Zero.
They'll get a big goose
sure.
egg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so as I say, keep him and sign him. Now, I know, Eli, that you were around over the weekend. Denny was in North Carolina at one of his card shows. So did you guys see both the Michigan State and Michigan games Friday night?
I saw.
Anybody see those games? I saw both.
I saw parts of both of games.
We know that Cassius Winston, who just is not playing well and didn't play well here against Wisconsin, now broke the all-time Big Ten assist leader record held by Mateem Cleaves, the former Michigan State great point guard who led them to a national title in 2000. So MSU routed Wisconsin coming back from Purdue. But now guess what? Michigan State has to play at Indiana Thursday night. They are 14-4. Then they have to play at Minnesota this coming Sunday afternoon on national TV. The Gophers are not having a great year, but you saw how they beat up on Michigan recently, 70-64, with Michigan having no answer for Minnesota sophomore Daniel Oturo, who kicked Teske's butt for 30 points. So it's so tough to win, as I always say, on the road in these major conferences. State could easily lose both these games.
It could. And, by the way, Michigan lost at Iowa Friday night. Michigan started out 7-0. They were a national story. Now they're 11-6. They're 6-7 since. Got more to talk about. I want to get back to Tom Brady and maybe the number one sporting event and the fastest of the weekend. But we have to say goodbye to our radio listeners in WCWA and WDFN. You have been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
So you kind of mentioned that in passing. I wanted to say this. I couldn't believe what I saw during the Michigan game when they let Luka Garza score 33 yeah. this time as the Hawkeyes came back to win. That was a great game, by the way, 90-83. So Garza's being interviewed after the game on television, and he seems somewhat surprised. You know, Michigan played him one-on-one in the first game at Ann Arbor, whereas you know he went off for an all-time Chrysler Arena record by any opponent of 44 points, so M wound up winning the game. So I had seen the Nebraska-Iowa game a couple, 3 weeks ago, and God, Nebraska not only won that game, they devised this amazing plan. Guy behind him, anytime Garza touches that ball, they collapse two guys on him besides the man guarding him, a guy outside and a guy inside. And they held him to, like, I think it was 16 points in that particular game. So I thought, well, Juwan's going to go to school on this. They're watching those tapes. We're going to see how we're going to stop him. They didn't. They played him one-on-one a lot. And then they double-teamed him a little bit every now and then. I thought it was a poor game plan by Juwan Howard and his staff on the best player in the Big Ten, with apologies to Cassius Winston. I thought Michigan should have done better. I really did.
I do, too. And Teske, he just isn't fast enough to really guard great centers, I don't think.
So you look at what's going on with Michigan. They've got Penn State in Ann Arbor Wednesday night, which is a good team, but I think Michigan's going to beat them at home. Then Michigan has to play Illinois at home, at Nebraska, back home for Rutgers. Michigan's going to win every single one of those games. So we're talking about moving up in the Big Ten conference standings, in the conference tournament standings, and thus in the NCAA standings probably as well.
Yeah, I don't take any of it that seriously because I still consider it the preseason. The last month is what counts as you're getting in shape for the NCAA tournament.
Yeah,
everybody's got at 64 teams, all have an equal chance.
And the good thing about this year is everybody's been number one so far. It's a great thing to see everybody rotating through that front door all the time and seeing who's going to be the sticker at the end of the season.
So over the weekend, Tom Brady was in Las Vegas on Saturday night. Why was he in Las Vegas, Bob?
Is who in Las Vegas?
Tom Brady was in Las Vegas talking to talking to Oakland Raiders owner Mark Davis. He was talking to him in Las Vegas there for UFC 246, where Conor McGregor, who is the combat sport superstar in the world, even though he's been losing lately. He hadn't won a fight since 2018, but he is the man, and he knocked out the cowboy Donald Cerrone in 40 seconds. And I'm watching the replay of this, and you know, John McCain called MMA human cockfighting.
Yeah.
It is so much more complex and I think interesting than boxing, which is just your hands.
You watch MMA?
I watch some MMA. Sometimes I have a hard time watching it, but I'm fascinated by it. And what you can do is, so in 40 seconds, he didn't need to land a punch. They're in a clinch with his shoulder. He goes with his shoulder into the guy's face, breaking his nose. He does it again into his face, and then 2 seconds later, with a roundhouse kick, how he gets his leg up 6.5 feet in the air is amazing. This is a remarkable sport, and it's been marketed so brilliantly that they spit. It's a sport. I mean, may be not a pretty sport, but it's a sport. Ooh. It's all one-on-one combat. $65 for the pay-per-view for 40 seconds, so that's $1.50 every second.
Every second.
But I'm a little fascinated by it, yes.
We got to get to Earl Curt, and I just would have to say this before that. Unfortunately, again, as we record this Monday, the Gerard Gallant watch only continues. Nothing yet. Another lost weekend for the Wings, beaten by Florida at home 4-1, which is a pretty good club, by the way, under Joel Quenneville. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they lost to the Penguins after leading 1-0 after two periods behind Jimmy Howard on Friday night. You know where Joel Quenneville's from, right? He's from Windsor.
Mm.
And recently, he won his 900th career game. You know that Joel Quenneville, who was a good defenseman for the Windsor Spitfires and played in the NHL for a long time, Joel Quenneville is now second only to the great Scotty Bowman on the all-time NHL coaching list for victories.
Didn't know that.
Very impressive. He's a god down here in Florida, at least with hockey fans, though nobody else knows who he is. His pictures are everywhere. It's like almost Chairman Mao pictures all over China his day. Everywhere you look down there, you see Joel Quenneville's here stuff.
Seven coaches fired this year, by the way, in the NHL. 5 for on ice stuff. The other stuff was for off the field or off the rink activities. But Blashill hangs in there, and that's why the
he does.
The Gallant watch continues.
Are you through Brady?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, just because he watched a match or sport with Davis doesn't mean he's going to.
No, it was just my segue into talking about the fight. Oh, okay. I knew nobody was interested.
Because there had to be at least 10,000 people that would have taken Tom to that match.
Yeah.
That's number one. Well, number two, Tom comes out the other day at the game, at the match.
The match?
And says he's embarrassed by the amount of money he makes and currently making. And then what he does, he goes off and talks about his family, and they are moving out of New England. But the bottom line is there's 13 other quarterbacks who make more money than he does.
Yeah, right. And he's going to make half what Pat Mahomes makes starting next year.
So we got the mailbag, we got Earl.
Mailbag. Real fast, I wanted to say that the fire in Australia that was the size of Switzerland, by the way. I don't know how big Switzerland is, but it sounds like a pretty big fire.
First of all, the country of Australia is as big as the United States. I don't know if you know that.
Is it that big?
It's that big. My son lives there. I can tell you a lot more about Australia than I ever thought about.
Brandon Square Miles, U.S. and Australia.
And he's very lucky. He lives south of all of this. He was about 300 miles south of the fires. But they got so much rain the other day, the fires are done.
That's good.
The smoke is the only thing now that's being...
Well, you know, they had the qualifying match, or the qualifiers for the Australian Open. People were coughing and couldn't hardly play. They're watching carefully to make sure that the right number of particulates in the air doesn't exceed a certain... Because it would be very deadly breathing that stuff. It's almost like what happened after 9/11. You're breathing that stuff that's floating in the air. In general, it's so hot there that sometimes the soles on their sneakers
melt.
And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out and whether they're even allowed to play some of these matches if that smoke doesn't go away.
Unbelievable.
Okay, you want to do mailbag?
Mailbag, bud?
I just asked you. Denny loves the mailbag. Denny always wants to do the mailbag.
Oh, Bob, I love you.
When you get letters like this, Denny, there's no wonder you want to do the mailbag.
Go ahead.
Listen to this letter. I've never heard anything like this, okay?
What happened?
Yes, Denny, believe it or not, I'll tell you what happened. And now, well, you just listen to this letter, okay, Denny? This is from Tim Gorman.
Did I do something bad?
A while back, I sent a message about getting a baseball signed for my mom for her birthday by Denny. I guess I read the message over the year, whatever it was, okay? So the weeks went by, and no baseball came in the mail. However, 6 weeks after her birthday, my wife reached out to Denny, and to her surprise, he texted back. The next day, I actually spoke to Mr. McLean and could not believe what he was telling me. He felt bad that the baseball never got to him, so he wanted to make it up to my mom. The kid, this guy apparently sent the baseball to you, Denny, and whatever. You said you didn't get it. So even though Denny's wife wasn't doing very well, and we know what happened with Sharon unfortunately passing away, Denny took time to meet my family for lunch. I was beside myself. I just set up a lunch for my parents with Denny McLean. Day came. When he showed up, my parents were stunned. Denny brought baseballs for everybody. He signed some other things I brought and had some other things for my boys, knickknacks and the like. We're a big baseball family. So the 2 hours went by very fast, and the stories Denny told us were great. I came to find out that Denny had to get a nurse to watch Sharon just to come have lunch with us that day. To do that, to spend a few hours with a fan, was incredible, and Mom is still telling everyone that'll listen that she actually had lunch with Denny McLean. I know I'm not the best at writing a letter, but you have no idea how much that meant to all of us. You are a great man, Mr. Ooh. Denny McLean.
Well, that's very
and
nice.
Thanks again.
A polarizing figure, but yes, nobody's better with fans than Denny
McLean.
That's
pretty impressive, Denny.
And let me say one other thing. I eat lunch every day.
Anybody remember a guy by the name of David Thompson? This is from Kurt Kosmowski. Guys, love the podcast. Working my way through your past episodes and listen to number 24 today. Great conversation. The closing statement by Bob, I prefer Pager, your hockey nickname. The closing statement by Bob was that Kareem and Walton were the two greatest college players, is one I largely agree with. But pump the brakes on Zion Williamson and his 1 year at Duke. David Thompson, and a lot of you younger people have no idea what I'm talking about. David Thompson was spectacular and led NC State to a national championship, and he was far more of an influence on college basketball in his day than Zion was in his day.
Yeah, David Thompson went only 6'4", but he was a leaper.
Monster.
And went on to play for the Nuggets, and at the end of the 78 season, scored 73 points in the final day of the season at Cobo Arena as he fought for the NBA scoring title with the great George Griffin.
I've got this down right here. And I was going to mention this before Eli got into it. I want to show you folks the difference in the media between what it is now and what it was when Eli and I were young and coming up. So this was indeed 1978, where he scored 73 points, even though Denver lost the Pistons 139-137. I remember this so well because it was a gorgeous spring day. It was a nothing game for the Pistons. I'm not going down to Cobo to see this. I'm going to enjoy this beautiful spring day. I didn't go to the game. I didn't see it, but I'm listening on the radio to what happened. I thought, oh, my God. Oh, no, I got it. I just turned my car around. I gun it down to Cobo Arena. Game's been over for half hour, 40 minutes. I walk into the Denver locker room. There's nobody in there. David Thompson's alone because there were no media. Nobody. David Thompson's alone lying on on the training table, icing down. And I did a one-on-one interview with David Thompson. And played it because I had to. I played it in the air for my audience the next day. You could just do that back then.
Well, back
there were no other media people.
I was at that game. I was there for the whole game. You came later. I don't remember.
Good for you. I'm jealous.
So the game is over, and I say, this is a pretty impressive performance. I take that back then they had this program called Hoop. I don't know if they still have the Hoop program when you go to an NBA game. I walk to center court after the game and say, David, would you sign this for me? Sure. So here I am, which is so unprofessional. You could never do it today. I walk to the middle of the court, and he signs an autograph for me. There's nobody around. And I think I've told this story. The year before was Bill Bradley's last game, and it was at Cobo Arena. Here's Bill Bradley, future Hall of Famer, future senator, one of the biggest stars in the game. It's his last game, and I walk into the visitor's locker room at Cobo. He's sitting on a trainer's table by himself. And I say, you got a couple of minutes? Sure. And I'm saying to myself, yeah. I'm actually talking to Bill Bradley right here, and there's nobody else around. That happened back then. It was amazing.
Absolutely. There was no sports talk radio. There was no sports talk radio. No internet. There was no ESPN,
And the NBA was a flea bag league at the time. It was not a very popular league. In fact, two years later, has been written many times, the NBA finals were on tape delay when Magic played five positions when Kareem was out, and they beat, they upset, who'd they upset? Did they upset Houston? Whoever they upset, it was or Philadelphia. The NBA finals were in tape delay, like at midnight. So,
one other thing too, you were talking about autographs. That you could not ask for autographs today. You ask for an autograph as a media guy today, they suspend your privileges.
Yeah,
you can't come back to the stadium.
Right, right.
Just a couple more things briefly, and then we'll get to Earl Curt and talk about his day and his NBA career. They're going to retire his uniform number at the University of Detroit during Thursday night's game. So this is one at our number, which you can call and leave a message. Text us 760-89-BALLS. Or, of course, the email address for the show is asknofilter@gmail.com. Here is – you ready for this, boys? Here is Cheryl from South Rockwood outside of Detroit. Hey, guys, love the show. I don't know if I'm the only girl who listens to your show, but keep up the good work. I love anything to do with the 84 Tigers. That was my team. Love the Milt Wilcox stories. Oh, my God, great interview. Also, I made my mom listen to the podcast. She's 70, and she remembers Denny McLain so well. She says Denny was so cute and remembers Denny doing all the Pepsi commercials he did back then. Denny, want to give out your personal cell phone number for Cheryl now? Or
of course.
It sounds like you might have a bunch of girls out there who'd like to meet you.
Every time we do an interview with somebody like Milt Wilcox, when it's over, I say, that's an interesting story. I didn't know that. Wow, that's great. And the story that stood out for me was as a rookie, where were they? Were they in Las Vegas? There's somewhere they went to the casino with Rose and Morgan, and he missed his curfew. And Sparky brought him in the next day because he missed his curfew and said, where were you last night? And he wouldn't throw Rose and Bench under the bus as a 20-year-old rookie. It was a really interesting story.
It's a nice story.
You don't believe.
It's a nice story. It's such a nice story.
Well, anyway, a wonderful guest of the program. Thank you, Cheryl, by the way. Lovely note. A recent guest of the program, Dan Wallach, the noted sports gambling expert, tweeted over the weekend, think about this, that it looks as though the path is now clear, and they're already talking about it, holding the Super Bowl in Las Vegas, Nevada, which, of course, they never would have done. You guys are so into this. What would a Vegas Super Bowl be like? Like the biggest party and zoo ever?
Well, I don't know.
Not going to happen in your lifetime.
I don't think it makes a difference. Because gambling is legal in many states, and anybody who wants to gamble, gambles. So I don't know how much more gambling will be done then.
Unless they can move a team to Vegas, it's not going to happen during our lifetime.
They're moving a team to Vegas. The Oakland Raiders are going there next year.
Once and if they get there, because they're still in court in California. Once they get there, then we can talk about the Super Bowl being in Vegas.
And finally, and Denny, don't you think Eli's behaved very well today? He's not uptight at all during the mailbag. He's not screaming for me to end it. And we had all these great notes about you on the show, Denny. Aren't you happy about that?
Well, that's very nice, Bob. Thank you very much. I really appreciate
it. That's very good. So here's our final note.
By the way, Bob, I'm trying to find somebody to take me to lunch.
Well, he's a little too far away. Yeah. All right.
It would never be
Bob.
Thank
you to Jerry Eversman, who listens on the radio down in the Toledo area. He sent us an interesting story on, ready for this, Roy Parmalee, a Lambertville, Michigan native right near the Ohio border, pitched for 10 years in the big leagues beginning in 1929 with the New York Giants. Wow. Pretty good hitter, too, for a pitcher as opposed to a present company. And with that, we'll see you again on another mailbag this coming Thursday.
Well, the University of Detroit, Detroit Mercy, Bob doesn't like that they call it Mercy. He'd prefer it would still be the old U of D, is going to raise the jersey of Earl Cureton to the rafters this Thursday, January 23rd. And Earl joins us now. Earl, you've had such a trek through college. You went to two different schools, Robert Morris, then U of D. You just trekked all over the world with the NBA. You played in Toronto. You played overseas. When you look back at all the years you played, what sticks with you for all those years in the NBA and the travels that you had now that you're a little bit older and can look back on it all?
Well, all of it was different experiences. There's no question about that. It was really eventful everywhere I went. It was always an adventure. But, you know, my Philadelphia days obviously were great. You know, we won a championship there in 83. You know, when I look back, that was probably that 83 year was like one of the best years I probably had in the NBA. Coming back home to Detroit was another great thing for me to come home and play in my hometown and with my teammates, with Tyler and Long. And, you know, and back, I didn't have an opportunity to do it in college with them, but we did play together for the Pistons for 3 years.
Yeah, you know, you played for the Pistons twice. You played for the Bulls. You played for the Rockets. You played for the Hornets. You played for the Clippers. The perseverance you showed, I mean, how many times you got cut? 6-7 times, and yet you kept on fighting, and people found you to be a useful NBA player that could help them. What do you think the key was? I know you were an excellent rebounder, not a great scorer. What was it about you, besides the fact that you were a great teammate and understood the game and could play defense, that enabled you to get rejected so many times and accepted so many times? That must have been tough in some ways.
I didn't get cut quite so soon. That didn't happen. I mean, I got cut twice, I think it was, in the NBA. You know, I stuck with most of the teams that I was with. I got released, I think the second time I came back here with Detroit. And, once, I think it was only two times. But basically, I was, I stuck with teams just about it. I went through free agency a couple of times to trade, to trades twice. It was all a great experience. I mean, I played for some good teams. When it's happening to you, you look at it as being a bad time when you're moving around like that. But at the end, when it all ended, it was a great experience for me because I had an opportunity to play with so many great guys. You know, I played with Michael Jordan. I had a chance to play with Isaiah Thomas. I had a chance to play with Hakeem Olajuwon. Every team I went to, I made a contribution. That was always my thing. I wasn't a guy that just was on a team just to be there. You know, I played the two years I went to the championship with Philadelphia. I had minutes where I played in the championship series. Here in Detroit, I was a starter for a long period of time with them on that team. And we went to the playoffs each and every year. We went there and had probably my best years playing here in Detroit. I was a starter with Michael Jordan down in Chicago when I was down there. So I bounced around a lot, but I was impactful with every team that I played for, and I wasn't cut six or seven times. That didn't happen.
Just three. Just three. I apologize for the exaggeration. Really, I do. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, that's a big exaggeration. Yeah.
Earl, I want to talk about your amazing basketball journey. When you came out of the University of Detroit, you're only a third-round pick, which doesn't exist anymore, as we know. You wind up with the Philadelphia 76ers. On that team, Dr. J himself and the late Daryl Dawkins, the strongest man in the world, as he once told me. Tell us about those two guys and what they were like as teammates and people.
Well, coming into Philly, and back then they had a thing called team eligibles, which Larry Bird was team eligible. I got drafted by Philly in the third round, but it was in my junior year, and I was a five-year senior. So, when I went there, I was projected to go early second or late first round my next year when I came out, but I opted to stay with Philadelphia. I had a chance. I could have went back into the draft that year, but I went to Philadelphia, and everybody wondered why I wanted to go there, because they had the best team in the league. And I said, if I'm going to a team, I want to go, where the best players are going to be at. And I idolized Dr. J growing up, and so I had an opportunity to go down there. And they had Daryl Dawkins, and of course, they had that team that was a superstar team back then with all the players. And I came in right on the tail end of that when they had World Peace 3 and Dawkins and McGinnis and all those guys right before I came in. And that had to be the cream of the crop of the league when I came in.
In 86-87, you played a year with the Bulls. Michael Jordan was your teammate. Tell us about that and practice every day, and what kind of guy was he?
Well, it was a great experience. I caught Michael when he was just starting to be Michael. I had played with Dr. J. That was the top of the league then. And, looking at Michael right there, just trying to make the comparisons. I didn't know Michael was going to turn out to be as great as he was at that particular thing, even though he was really good then. But he wasn't Dr. J then, he evolved to be Dr. J as it went on, or better. And it was a great experience playing with Mike. I remember him scoring 50 points the first game we played down in Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
And I said, God, I said, this guy's pretty good, we went down and played the Knicks down there in the very first game with him. We went in there, me and Oakley and him and Corzine and that crew. He went in there and dropped 50 points. But, he was a hard-working guy. He held everybody accountable. He was a leader at a very young age. He wanted to win, and obviously, it all paid off for him. Winning six championships.
Earl, this is Denny McClain. Let me ask you, what do you see dramatically the difference between today and the kids that you played with?
Well, things are a lot different. It's more teams now. I mean, obviously, when I was in the league, with the teams they got, it's 30-some teams in the league. It was 24 teams when I first came to the league.
Right.
They cut the numbers down a whole lot in terms of players. The guys are leaving out of school a lot younger now. I think guys were a lot more polished. I think 4 years of college really make kids more fundamentally sound in what they are. And then the athleticism and the size and the skill level in terms of big, being more mobile, and the game has changed in that aspect. But in my time, I think guys were a little bit more skilled for the fact that they had coaching. I mean, a lot of these guys now, they do a year, a couple of years of AAU basketball, or 1 year of college and then straight to the NBA. And I don't think they get quite as polished as they did in my time.
Make us laugh. What was the minimum salary back then?
First round draft picks was getting around $40,000 back then. I remember the year that came out. I remember Larry Stinson probably signed with the Golden State Warriors about $40,000. I mean, you figure Dr. J was what, the $6 million man, $1 million a year. It's a huge difference in salaries, and we paved the road for all that stuff to happen. Of course, television and merchandise and all that stuff wasn't as big as it is now, and back then, it just wasn't as big. But we paved the way and made things happen. David Stern, was a big part of that. We just lost him. Yeah. He was a great pioneer for the game of basketball. That he had a vision that he saw, and now look what he's doing now.
Now, didn't Dick Vitale? Now he was already the athletic director by the time you played, right? Did he recruit you though?
Vitale recruited me. He brought me in there. I went through the recruiting process, and then when I got to U of D, the Pistons took Vitale away. Right. He ended up going to coach the Pistons, and I came in when John and Tyler were seniors. That was my redshirt year, there at the University of Detroit. Yeah. I came in from Robert Morris College. My process was a process of growth. Coming out of high school at 6'5", I shot up 4 inches my first year down at Robert Morris College. That school went from a junior college to an NCAA Division I. But all these things played a factor in me developing into a decent basketball player. I had an opportunity to play a year of Division I for Robert Morris. I played against Larry Bird. I played against Wayne Cooper. I played against Sly Williams. I averaged about 17 and 10 points a game my sophomore year in college, which makes it a first round draft pick now. So when I came to Detroit, I came in right when Tyler and John was leaving and Vitale exit, but me and Terry Durod, had a couple of good seasons here together at the University of Detroit.
Earl, I want to continue a little bit with your basketball journey. I want to ask you two-part question. First of all, you played in Italy for a year. I want to know what that was like. And then, of course, in a big thrill for you, you got to come home and play for the Pistons for three seasons, just missing the Bad Boys era. So go ahead. What are your thoughts on those two issues?
Like I said, when I said it was a venture every year that I was in the league, I played 3 years in Philadelphia. And back in that time, they had this rule in the NBA, right of first refusal. Even when you became a free agent, you still wasn't a free agent. The team had the right to get compensation from you.
Right.
So you couldn't sign with another team. So they had the right to ask any team in the league. And, me being in Philly, that was one of the top teams. The rookies didn't play a lot of minutes. Obviously, I didn't play a lot of minutes back then. But I did make contributions in the championships, and I was always there and dependable when they needed me. But when I became a free agent, Philadelphia didn't offer me a fair contract, but yet they wasn't going to let me go anywhere. So I was stuck with Philadelphia. I had to take whatever they offered me, and nobody was going to give up a first and a second round draft pick and pay me too. That wasn't going to happen. So that rule was like a horrible rule. It would stop player movement. So it was my decision. They offered me a contract, but I didn't sign that. I didn't sign that contract. The only way I could get around the right of first refusal was to leave the country. So I left the country and went to Italy.
Tell us about that. What an amazing cultural experience it must have been. The basketball was great too, wasn't it?
Well, it was a tough decision, but for a guy that was hungry to get in the NBA, I actually left the NBA because I couldn't get the proper contract that I thought I should deserve to get. So I took off, and they offered me the contract, and the money went what I thought it should be. And so I got a chance, and I knew if I left for 1 year, I did my research and found out if I leave for a year, that Philadelphia would no longer have the rights to me anymore. So I went over there, and the relationship I had developed with Chuck Daly as my assistant coach, he knew all about me. He knew who I was, knew how hard I worked, knew how dedicated I was. So I lasted about 2 months over in Italy. And then Jack McCloskey gave me a phone call, and they brought me back and signed me to a 3-year deal. And I think Philadelphia ended up getting like a third round draft pick. It turned out to be Chucky Brown, so they still ended up getting a pretty good player out of it.
Almost 10 years later, you won a championship with the Rockets and play with Hakeem Olajuwon. Who were the best five centers that you played with? Because you were a forward center, you played against all of them in your era from 1980 almost up to 2000. Who do you consider the greatest centers in the game?
Well, no question, Kareem, had to be one of the top centers in the league. Moses Malone, right up at the top of everything, that I played with. Hakeem Olajuwon, that Moses taught how to play basketball, was another great center that I played with. I guess you got to put Lambeer in that mix with Detroit, because he was one of the first stretch fives in the league that gave tennis all kind of nightmares. He was a rebounder, and not only could he rebound, if you think about it, he was one of the first guys to shoot the shot from way out of the three-point line. Because centers had a tough time matching up with Lambeer just for the fact that he could knock down that long shot. Alvin Adams, a couple other guys that was in the league were able to shoot the outside shot. But back then, all the centers were posted up back to the basket-type player. But those were some of the good ones that I played with.
So to wrap it up here, on Thursday, they're going to retire your number. Obviously, the Titans go back to your roots, the Dick Vitale, the hometown. You got your degree there in 2011, fulfilling the promise you made to your mom. What will it mean to you Thursday night?
I think it'll be a pretty emotional night for me. I mean, I never expected, for something like that to happen to me growing up here in the city of Detroit. To have an opportunity to get your number retired in your hometown, and with the University of Detroit, and looking at some of the names that are hanging up there right now with Spencer Haywood, David Busher, with John Long, and with Terry Tyler, and Terry Durod, Rashad Phillips has just recently went up there. For me to go up there with a group of guys like that and Bob Callahan and the Raptors, I mean, that's a great honor. And I think as it gets a little bit closer each day, I start thinking about what great of honor that is to have your number retired.
Well, you've made the city of Detroit proud of you. You've been here a long time. You've maintained your loyalty. You've played for the local teams, and you remain on the air with them doing their games, and you've just been an all-around good guy. And thanks for joining us today, Earl, and best of luck.
Earl, congratulations.
All right, thanks
Thank
a lot.
You, Earl.
Okay. Have a good one. Thanks, Earl.
All right, now. Bye.
Nice man. Very nice man.
Yeah. Earl's a great guy. Yeah. God, you know, Eli, you and I have known him for forever. How many years? Good forever. Heavens, forever. And you know what? For those of us, and Denny, I know you were one of them, for those of us who love to play basketball, could you imagine a journey like that? He's not a Hall of Famer, but playing all those places with all those guys for all the – how cool is that?
I'll tell you one thing. It takes a lot of guts to leave the United States and go play someplace else.
He played in Argentina too briefly.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So
if you guys want to wrap it up, that's fine. I got one other note. You guys got anything else to say? If you don't, I got one quick note here.
We're kind of getting pressed up against the next show.
Here's the note. There's a fan named Dave Hogg, H-O-G-G, who published this on Twitter just the other day. I've not checked it out, and I'm not going to check it out because it's way too much work. But the three of us have been asking this question on this show for quite some time now. We've been waiting for a quantitative research amount of info on this subject for quite a while now. And that is, has there ever been a city in the history of professional sports with four losing teams like Detroit has now that's been worse? What city in the history of American sports has ever had four teams as bad as these in Detroit lost as many games?
I will tell you this, with the exception of the Yankees, New York's pretty close.
So anyway, here's the answer. What? Hogg writes, the 226 losses suffered totally by all four Detroit teams in the calendar year 2019 are not only the most in Detroit sports history, but the most of any city or market in any calendar year. In the history of North American sports.
Isn't that amazing? Well, the Tigers' 114 losses contributed quite a bit to that. Wings and – yeah, it makes sense.
And I want you to do a little research. Come up with the New York teams. Let's figure out what New York – because they were horrible this year too. Yeah, except for the Yankees.
The New York – we have nine major league sports teams in New York. So they're not going to have any kind of a, you know, in total, I guess they could lose more games than that. But we've got nine teams there. Yeah. And you have to remember also that every sport also plays a lot more games now than they used to. So that could be a small factor in this. But that's just a notion of how awful things truly are.
And on that
buy a calculator.
We'll see you later. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll see you again Thursday.
Thanks, Bob.